This is Ken Hollings. And this is Hollingsville. Welcome, traveller. Welcome indeed to Hollingsville, where we keep on fixing things until they're broken. In this series, I'm taking an accompanied stroll around the world of tomorrow, poking into some of the dustier exhibits that we can find in some of the pavilions dedicated to the spirit of transport, the thrust towards the future, and our friend agriculture. This particular episode is the third in the series. It's called Machines, History and Hardware. And joining me at the loom later on will be a composer and musician, Bruce Woolley, and writer and editor, James Bridle. And the musical interludes we'll be hearing during the course of the program are from a new outfit called Radiophonic. I think you'll enjoy what they have to offer us. I deliberately used the word hardware in the subtitle because I wanted for this particular program to move, to begin with, away from the notion of machines in terms of what they produce, in terms of the software, in terms of what we consume from them, and instead look at them rather as pieces of equipment, pieces of actual physical mechanism that have had quite far-reaching influences upon how we perceive, how we behave, how we consume, etc. And in a sense, you can't go back far enough in terms of a mechanical history, a history of machines. You can't go back far enough. Records prohibit us a little bit, and we sometimes have to pick our occasions carefully in order to triangulate or pinpoint, I think, particular moments when the relationship with technology, with machines, undergoes one of these small but significant shifts. For me, one major seismic movement took place in the year 1895, and it was a year in which two particularly significant, as far as I'm concerned, events took place. One was quite near the beginning of the year. It was a new production of the Tchaikovsky ballet Swan Lake with choreography by Marius Petipa. What's particularly interesting about this rather tragic tale of love and passion and the embracing of death with a little bit of magic on the side is the entrance of the swans in Act Two. This is a large number of women who have been transformed into swans who appear at the lake at midnight. And their entrance is quite singular because you have an entire corps de ballet dressed identically, made up to resemble each other, slowly filing in a kind of serpentine line down the apron stage. And as they do so, they all copy the movements of the person in front of them, the dancer in front of them. So you get the same gestures repeated almost in a kind of physical canon that proceeds to work itself through this line as they enter onto the stage. And the result actually looks quite like a piece of parlor magic. It particularly resembles, for me, the effect you get peering through the slats of a zoetrope. Zoetrope, this Victorian predecessor of the cinema, where you would actually get like a small repeated gesture made up of individually small drawings that would repeat itself as the zoetrope spun round. Balancing that, and coming up a little later in 1895, we have the Lumiere brothers presenting their first cycle of films before a cafe audience in Paris. They covered all kinds of subjects, but the film that interests me most is actually the first one that they made, which is known in English as Exit from the Factory. The Lumiere brothers actually filmed it outside the gates of their family factory, and it shows a lunchtime shift coming out of the wooden gates. And what's particularly striking about this short sequence is the number of women. It's a large number of female factory hands, all on foot. The few males that deign to appear in their midst are either riding bicycles or sat up high on a dray pulled by horses. But you get this tremendous tumbling cascade almost of women coming out of the gates, which in many ways seems the complete antithesis of the ordered choreography, the organized choral lines of the dancers in Petipa's ballet. And yet they have a lot in common. They both of them, if you like, are responding to the presence of machines. They're both also completely disenfranchised from that experience. This is 1895. Universal suffrage is still a long way off, unless you're in New Zealand, apparently. So we're talking about, you know, a group of women who have really no voice, have no real presence, who are, as it were, trapped within a particularly kind of sexualized glance. Swan Lake, again, I remind you, is about love, passion, seduction, magic. Doesn't end happily, or ends incredibly happily, depending on how you feel about renouncing the world. The factory women, let us not forget, were already the subject of medical, social studies that were concerned that the gentle, repeated insistence of the machine's movements that they were operating in the workshop and in the factory and in the seamstress's studio, that these delicate, small, gentle, repeated movements were actually throwing them into a kind of erotic reverie in which, you know, their minds really weren't on what they were doing. This, again, not just as this before universal suffrage, this is also before Taylorism. So the notion of a kind of scientific organization of human behavior has yet to be completely formulated and put into practice. And yet, we have a relationship with machines on display here, very clearly on display here. And we owe that presence to, I think, one man in terms of how this presence is articulated, a particularly interesting man called Franz Rouleau, who not only was the head of the patents office in Germany, a position which allowed him to have the undivided attention of the Kaiser, but he was also the inventor, the deviser of something called kinematics. This was a science which allowed you to organize how the essentially rotary motion produced by steam power and water power, which was still the big power source of the 19th century, it allowed you to translate rotary movement into other kinds of movement. So in other words, you used ratchets and wheels and drives and pulleys and belts, and you could organize them into what he called a kind of language of machines. You could put these pieces together. He actually produced 800 different combinations of various components in order to change one movement to another. Now, he actually coined what is still the kind of essential definition of what a machine is. I mean, this is the basis of the dictionary definition you will find. And he defined it as this: a machine is a combination of resistant bodies so arranged that by their means the mechanical forces of nature can be compelled to do work accompanied by certain determinate motions. Resistant bodies, forces of nature, compelled, determinate motions. This is the language of coercion. This is the language of force here. This book appears in 1876 in German. It appears in an English translation in 1877. But wait, there's more. 1877 is the year in which Edison first reveals to the world the phonograph. Hailed by Scientific American with the great declaration, speech has become immortal. Speech has become immortal. Actually, speech hasn't become immortal. Some kind of version of language in a recorded form has come into being. But in this moment, there is a huge gap beginning to open up between our senses. Suddenly, speech has a life of its own, or an immortality of its own, if you will. And its immortality shades the opposite. It shades mortality, vulnerability, I think it's no mistake or accident that Edison thought of the phonograph as something that had nothing to do with music. He wasn't interested in it as a device for recording music. For him, it was a business machine. For him, in finer, wilder moments, it was possibly a device for either communicating with the dead or preserving the last gasp of the moribund. But music, nah. Why? Because he was almost stone deaf. I mean, he actually had to yell into the mouthpiece of the phonograph. And in a funny kind of way, it's not until the gramophone comes along that we suddenly see the shift over into something more like music, as a device that can record music. By then, however, the cinematograph has begun to sort of like make inroads. By 1895, there's a particularly interesting man called Georges Demenet, who takes the immortality of speech a little bit further by creating the photography of speech. His idea is that he's actually going to train deaf mutes how to talk to the rest of the world by photographing his face as he pronounces particular phrases and words, and then get people to copy the grimaces that he pulls so that they can, as it were, create a sounding board in their own with their own skull in order to copy these words. Wasn't a blistering success. He actually went back to his original passion, which was athletics. But the kind of codicil to this story is that Georges Demenet has a brother, Paul, who has some significance in the history of literature. Paul Demenet, the brother, is the recipient, one of two recipients, of a letter that the poet Arthur Rimbaud writes in 1870. The famous Lettre du Voyant, the seer's letter, in which he lays out a systematic method of what he calls the deregulation of the senses in order to transform the poet into something far more spiritual, far more visionary, far more powerful. And he calls it the systematic deregulation of the senses. And it's in this letter that he makes the really famous statement, "I is another." He's already writing about the self as being something removed, something that has been copied, something that has been mechanically reproduced. He actually says you can't fault a piece of brass for turning out to being a bugle, you know, which is interesting. He uses a musical metaphor here. You know, I think of think of the horn of a phonograph when I think of this brass being turned into a bugle. And echoing Rimbaud's sense of disorientation, dislocation of the senses, we have Friedrich Nietzsche near the end of the century sitting over his Hansen Malling writing ball, which actually resembles a kind of robot hedgehog, which has actually been designed to enable blind people to communicate with the sighted. The interesting thing about the writing ball is that the paper actually goes underneath the ball, so you can't actually see what you're typing. But then again, why would you want to? That wasn't the idea, to accommodate sighted people at this point. But it leads Nietzsche to make two observations. The first one is, he says, look at how our writing implements influence the way we think. They work upon the way we think. And he also says, in the first book that he wrote with a typewriter, The Genealogy of Morals, he comes out with this fabulous rhetorical question, which seems like a good moment to have a little interval. He looks up, as it were, from his writing ball and says, are these humans now, or are they writing and thinking machines? Was Radiophonic with Avatar Original, featured Steve Dubb at the controls there. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville. And I'm very, very pleased to welcome into the studio my two guests, Bruce Woolley and James Bridle. And we're going to sort of poke around in one of the tea rooms, one of the many themed tea rooms at this World's Fair, where I'm sure we'll find a decent cup of coffee and a slice of Battenberg cake to distract us with. Bruce, I guess a lot of people would immediately associate you with the song video Killed the Radio Star.
Oh yes.
Which you co-wrote with Trevor Horn.
Yeah.
The thing I find interesting about that song, apart from its extraordinary longevity and the fact that it's one of those songs that keeps kind of readapting itself, without great effort, it seems to me, to changes in how we listen to and consume music. But it's always occurred to me that at the heart of it, there is very much a sense of machines dominating the voice, the singing voice in it. I think particularly in my mind and in my car, we can't go back, we've come too far. The idea of tape machines and cars somehow pushing us beyond the limits of what's sustainable as a human. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's a fair interpretation of that song in the 21st century?
Well, it's one interpretation, that's for sure. I mean, what occurred to me way after writing it was how layered it was in meaning, really. I don't want to sound pretentious about that, but sometimes when you write something, and I'm sure, Ken, you know this, and James, you as a publisher, you take things sometimes initially on face value, and then you realise that you've actually written, or something else is coming out of that composition or text that you had no idea existed. So it kind of releases ideas, I think, and certainly the kind of level one idea of machines or technology changing humans is the kind of central theme of Video Killed the Radio Star. And I think also the way we're perhaps evolving with technology.
I think at the time also, I mean, video was this relatively new medium. It was still a very kind of heavy, clunky, machine-operated format.
Yeah,
you know, when you think about the old VHS and Betamax and Grundig 2000 systems, they were fairly cumbersome.
Well, I mean, they got a lot of moving parts. I mean, it's like a Swiss watch. I mean, there's just literally there's a lot of moving parts, and I think what we're seeing now is a move away from that. That's a very Victorian kind of concept. You know, wheels, cogs, the sort of things you were talking about earlier about kinetics, and with the movement into digital, that is being kind of left behind in so many instances. So, yeah, I mean, it was, that sort of built-in nostalgia. I don't know.
Built-in nostalgia. Nostalgia guarantee. But at the same time, I mean, the song itself is expressing nostalgia for radio, which, you know, as we were discussing in the previous program, has a wonderful habit of never going away. It just doesn't seem to matter what, you know, what new media, what new devices come along. Radio still somehow, maybe because of its ethereal nature, ends up withstanding these kind of changes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know you're very interested in and very passionate about vintage electronic instruments, and particularly the theremin. I know you've been very kind of active what do you call it, the theremin circle?
The theremin circle. Mm. It started back in Madame Jojo's in the late 90s, actually. Yeah, indeed.
A lot of things started at Madame Jojo's.
And I think at that time, nobody had played a theremin in England since 1927. And we managed to track one down. Actually, there was one guy called Richard Cole from the Science Museum who actually had, a theremin, but he didn't really do public performance with it. So we kind of took a little instrument which was built by Vince Clark's his brother, would you believe, and had valves sticking out of the top of it, and mounted it on a stage, Madame Jojo's, and started playing it. You couldn't play a tune at all, but it made a waveform that was quite engaging. But since then, those years ago, the theremin has proliferated worldwide. I mean, it's a huge kind of cult now, really.
Why is that? I mean, I once got into trouble by describing the theremin as, you know, an instrument that has a glorious future behind it. In that, you know, I mean, you know, Bob Moog comes along, builds an analog synthesizer that's, you know, that's modular and has keys, and suddenly the notion of sliding scales, glissandi, all these kind of special effects seem kind of stranded in a future that never quite happened.
Well, I mean, you say that, Ken, but I mean, when the RCA theremin first came out it was 1939, actually, they advertised it as the RCA theremin, an absolutely new, unique instrument anyone can play. And it finishes off by saying, it is destined to be the universal musical instrument. People will play it as easily and naturally as they now write or walk. And that, of course, just didn't happen. But as the instruments now are proliferating because they're easier to manufacture, more and more people are playing them. So its future is yet to be revealed, I think.
Reversing that slightly, looking at its origins, I'm always fascinated by when a machine becomes an instrument. I mean, for example, I mean, if we look at a piano, essentially, it's a big mechanism. It's a big machine designed to produce, you know, it's nicely tempered now, but essentially it's just wheels and hammers and levers and tuned strings. But we think of it, that's an instrument. It has a vocabulary, it has a body of sounds associated with it. It organizes things in ways that we're very comfortable with. The theremin, unless I'm wrong, didn't it start out as a device used for measuring gases?
This is an interesting question, because I think Leon Theremin stumbled across the concept because he was a cellist in the radio battalion of the Red Army during the Russian Revolution, and worked with radio equipment. And I think he discovered that effect where you get closer to a radio in the old days when you had to tune a radio, and it kind of went wow and made funny noises. I think he just saw the musical potential of that. I mean, you've got to remember, only a few years before that, the first electronic instrument in New York was devised, which was the telharmonium. And you know about the telharmonium. It was big, really big. In fact, it weighed 200 tons. And the only way you could hear it was through the telephone on a pair of headphones. You'd have to subscribe, pay a subscription, and the player would be in an underground cavern in New York playing this instrument, which had this massive metal generators to produce the sounds. It's like a 200-ton iPod.
I'm going down into my laboratory now, Igor, just to play some tunes for you. Pick up the phone in 30 seconds.
So, I mean, yeah, so it didn't last very long as a consequence, but when valves came along, that revolutionised everything, and that's so Leon Theremin kind of made the first portable electronic musical instrument.
While you were talking, it occurred to me that perhaps the kind of renewed interest in the theremin is somehow symptomatic or expressive of a more welcoming attitude towards technology within, for the moment, let's say, the music industry. You know, that after you know, a large amount of resistance, you know, the modular synthesizer, the guitar amplifier, you know, this is all primitive stuff. It's all destroying music.
Yeah.
We've reached a point now where we're kind of accepting that these big changes have taken place. And I was going to bring James Bridlin at this point because I was very interested in your website dedicated to, as it were, getting the publishing industry over its technophobia. And I'm wondering where our theremin moment is going to be in publishing.
I don't know about a theremin moment, but I love the concept of this huge machine in New York that you listen to on the telephone. It sounds kind of reflecting back to the first computers where you had a kind of massive mainframe thing with all these kind of odd bits off. Like it's in fact a kind of precursor to all previous musical instruments. You had to kind of centralize them all in this huge basement first before you could gradually miniaturize it and kind of send it out into the world, which I guess is what happened with electronic instruments. I guess I'm not going to answer the question about the publishing industry. I'm going to talk about machines. What happened with the theremin is that you kind of had to go back to a previous thing to kind of find some new routes to go through with electronic music, and that's kind of what we seem to be doing with computers and machines now as well. I'm a bit obsessed at the moment with these various kind of human. The internet's enabled humans to become computers again. I'm fascinated with the idea that the first computers were actually people. For the first few hundred years, the word computer was applied to people, not to machines, and it's starting to become again. There's Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which is essentially a device for splitting up huge amounts of work and sending it out to lots of people on the internet who are paid in pennies to do it. And there's translation engines now, which actually are more important because they use human translation rather than machine translation. It's more reliable. And we seem to have sort of gone full circle in these technologies. And as we go back and analyze things like the theremin or things like the early computers, we find these kind of new ways to go out and explore other things.
It's very interesting you say that the computer was originally applied to a person, because exactly the same thing happened with the typewriter. The typewriter was the secretary rather than the instrument that the secretary would be using. And, I still find it really fascinating that, you know, particularly in terms of, like, the handling, the operating of machines, the keyboard, from the point of view of people who write, the keyboard is the QWERTY keyboard. It's not the well... You know, it's our equivalent of the well-tempered clavier, if you like, is the QWERTY keyboard. And I'm really interested in how... You know, applications are beginning to sort of like bring this arrangement of keys back after the sort of magic square that we've had on the mobile phones.
Yeah, I mean the QWERTY keyboard itself is a complete aberration and an anachronism because it's designed for the typewriter and it's actually a really bad keyboard design for computers. I don't know if we could have some kind of theremin interface to the computer. I would enjoy that more. That's maybe the touch interface on new devices.
You mean like a space-controlled keyboard, a space-controlled interface, perhaps a three-dimensional matrix, which you can just sort of...
Absolutely. You'd be starting to play the computer rather more than simply just command it.
Mm. It's interesting how quickly beyond the machine, we almost go straight away into this kind of invisible dimension in which the machine itself falls away. That's why I think it's interesting that photography, cinematography, the recording of sound all lends itself to the, communication with the dead, communication with the beyond, those who are actually beyond instrumentality. I think, you know, for example, the early logos for the big record labels, EMI and HMV. I mean, EMI's was the recording angel, sort of gazing off dreamily into the middle distance while inscribing the spiral groove of a record with this large pen that it's holding. Mm. And there is this idea of, you know, the actual life itself being written in this spiral groove out that just goes endlessly outwards. And of course with HMV, Nipper, I assume it's some kind of Jack Russell, peering mm-hmm. into the brass horn of, I'm going to have to say it's a phonograph this time. What's he listening to? His master's voice.
Yeah.
Where's
yeah.
his master? He's gone before. And yet the dog instinctively recognizes the voice played back.
Probably sounded like that.
But he recognized it. And it seems like these devices are always opening up onto, in a sense, you know, the notion of the avatar, this other dimension. And so from that point of view, I mean, I love the idea that we could dispense with the keyboard. I think I'd be a little sad to begin with. My fingers know that keyboard so well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking to someone who's trying to devise a guitar that basically is doesn't have strings, and it's basically a sort of digital strip that you can print, you know, and it can read pressure and all the rest of it, and you can actually attach it to anything. So it's like it has pixels basically, and you use your fingers to play it, but the thing is, if you take the string away, you're actually going to miss that, because part of the whole deal with the guitar is the flex, it's the resistance. And there's to some extent, I think when you're typing something, there's a kind of physical sort of feedback, what Bob Moog would call a cybernetic feedback loop, you know, where you start to become one with the machine, if you like. That sounds a bit grand, but there is that connection, that physical connection, that sometimes you'd miss if you took it away.
I just can't help but, when you describe a guitar with this tape running through it, I can't help but thinking of the Turing's Universal Machine, which is Turing's description of this universal computer that was simply an infinite roll of tape with marks on it that mm-hmm. the computer could read and write on. And you can reduce any set of instructions, any computational algorithm, to this, simply inscribing marks on this endless loop of paper that the Turing machine reads and writes. It's the kind of foundation of all computer science. And what you're describing always sounds like kind of universal, or the beginnings of a universal, well, almost a universal instrument, any kind of thing.
Yes, it would,
Except in the case of Turing's universal machine, I'm really pleased that you brought that up, because I find it really fascinating that Turing comes up with this notion. This is the basis of all computing. It's a non-existent machine. It can only ever exist as a list of instructions, theoretically. I mean, that's how it was posited. Turing, I think, came up with it because he was attempting to refute some proposition in symbolic logic, which makes my forehead bleed just to even contemplate it now. But he's doing it at Cambridge, late 1920s, early 1930s, and there are people like I.A. Richards teaching a new form of literary criticism at the same time, which involves the idea of dismantling text, of actually seeing it as a set of images, as a set of ideas, rather than some kind of harmonious, you know, arrangement of pretty language. And from that point of view, I tend to think of the Universal Machine as actually being one of the best damn poems the 20th century ever produced, you know, because it's just a perfect text that refers to something that isn't there, but yet you can actually grasp it intellectually at the same time. And as you say, and it's all machines are there. That's why it's the universal machine. It can replicate the behavior of any other machine, including itself. I think this would be a wonderful time to have another little interlude from our guest musicians, Radiophonic. Thank you. This is Ken Hollings, and this is Hollingsville, and that was Silver Strawberries by Radiophonic with Steve Dubb very much in control on that particular number. This show, it's called Machines, History and Hardware, and I'm joined in the studio by Bruce Woolley and James Bridle. And James is going to tell me about Menace.
Menace is the machine Edgeable Noughts and Crosses engine. It was a thought experiment in the 60s by Donald Michie, one of the founding fathers of machine intelligence. And he devised this machine that it was a way of demonstrating the way in which machines could learn through reinforcement. And that's the kind of very basic form of machine intelligence that might be one of the routes to which we reach this unattainable goal of true artificial intelligence. And what it is, it's a series of 304 matchboxes, and each matchbox corresponds to a possible layout of a noughts and crosses game in progress. And so the machine has an operator, and the machine plays against a human player. And after every turn, it looks at the state of the board, and you select the matchbox on which that board state is inscribed, and you give the matchbox a shake. And because there's some coloured beads inside the matchbox, and because there's a little nook that selects one of those beads, that bead corresponds to the move you'll make next. So in that way, the machine plays. But also, over time, the machine learns, because every time it wins a game, extra beads are added according to the moves that it made successfully, and unsuccessful beads are removed. So over time, it gets better until it becomes a perfect matchbox, a perfect noughts and crosses player.
This sounds to me a little bit like the process that Turing was formulating when he devised the Turing test.
Yeah, I mean these kind of pen and paper solutions have a really strong history in all kinds of computing. I mean, Turing did a lot of his proofs on paper because you know these guys were mathematicians. So they used to kind of just formulating this stuff in their head, but when they got an algorithm, they started to run it on paper. One of Turing's other early programs was one of the first computer chess programs. Which he never had a computer that he could actually run it on, but he would run it on pieces of paper. It took him and his colleagues about 2 or 3 days to run a game of chess, apparently using algorithms that he developed. It's a very bad program, but it was one of the first.
But you actually built the Matchbox engine.
Yeah, I actually built Menace because the idea of it had been
obsessed
me
for
years. It's a lovely thing. It's a real object, and you can touch it and play with it. And I was just kind of frustrated that it didn't seem to exist in the real world. I haven't found any records of anyone actually building it. I don't know if Mitchie did, or any of his students, or anyone since. I've seen similar devices on a smaller scale. There's lots of kids apparently in America build one for a simplified version of noughts and crosses that only has three squares, and they quite often build them, and that only takes nine match boxes, whereas this took 304.
I didn't even know there were 304 matchboxes.
I have a phone
in London.
There was a man in the corner shop who actually managed to get me a special delivery. So yes, he saved Menace at the last moment.
Oh man! Yes, we need smarter machines. Give me more matchboxes.
Absolutely. Well, the reason I built Menace was because I was kind of obsessed with this idea of these physical computers, how far you could stretch them, how big and how complicated you could build something that you could still interact, you know, with your fingers, digitally, with your fingers. And I built Menace really as an experiment to see how big Menace would be, and therefore what it would take to build computers that operated the same way on a larger scale. So the final kind of leap of the thought experiment beyond Menace was to design Mage, which was the Matchbox Go engine, and Go being this unbelievably complex board game with a 96 possible points, two players, four different board states, and simply unimaginable numbers. And I was hoping that one day I'd build one, but when I finally did the calculations, I discovered that the Matchbox Go engine, if done to the same proportions as the Matchbox Noughts and Crosses engine, would be slightly larger than the Crab Nebula, which somewhat put paid to that ambition.
Yeah, I can't see that turning up as an iPhone app anytime soon. But what a magnificent thought. You know, the Crab Nebula blotted out by matchboxes, all working in unison.
Yeah. It's just kind of trying to visualise the kind of vast repositories of computing power that we do actually have at our disposal. We haven't built a machine that can play Go yet, though. So that is kind of, that can play it well. People can still beat that, unlike chess. But there are ways of kind of explaining these huge technologies through things that we can still touch and feel.
I mean, when you say you know, that your device can learn to play noughts and crosses without being fatuous, I mean, to what level?
Well, it can become a perfect noughts and crosses player. Unfortunately, a perfect noughts and crosses player means a draw every time. So it's not the most exciting of games to play, but it is absolutely perfect. But, you know, noughts and crosses is a very simple game.
And there we have our thinking writing machine in Matchbox 4. I'm while you were talking about that, I was this image came into my mind, which I absolutely love, which is the someone took one of the KUKA industrial arms, you know, this German company. I mean, I think they were established in around 1870. I mean, they're part of that great founding age of machines, and they developed a robot arm, which was programmed to write on a seemingly endless roll of paper. It could transcribe the entire Luther Bible. And sometimes at night I lie there thinking of this arm just sort of working away, writing out, you know, one of the first duplicated books ever.
Margaret Atwood, the novelist, she actually funded the development of a machine called the Long Pen, which is a similar thing. I think it might be an environmental protest that she thought it was wrong that as an author she went to signings and flew all around the world. So she developed this machine, which is an operator sits at one end and uses a pen, and the machine tracks the moon to this pen and translates that to the mate of the Long Pen machine, which is in a bookstore somewhere far away signing books for customers. And she actually paid for the development and the building of this. But purely to sign books at a distance. But it's always struck me that at some point, some part of her or some avatar of her would kind of inhabit the machine, and the machine would just end up writing the books itself as well. You know, this would be the logical conclusion of the process.
Yeah, but do you want it signed? Because we...
I don't know. I mean, I love Margaret Atwood, but it seems it's an extraordinary kind of vanity act to create a machine that replicates your own signature at a distance. But I guess that's the basic principle of all kind of androids and such like robots, that we're just trying to recreate some kind of human presence, and I guess a signature is kind of one quite strong signifier of that presence.
This is something Bruce and I have talked about quite a lot in the past, which is with what happens when having postulated this idea that there is a kind of robot replica of human experiences, human perceptions, human actions, how the nearer they get to the human, the less human they actually seem.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if there's a stage in between there, Ken, with, I think the term is transhumanization, which is where people are actually beginning to enhance their own bodies with exoskeletons and artificial limbs, obviously in the case where people need an artificial limb, and can actually are actually becoming part machine. I know that's perhaps a bit excessive, but you can already, soldiers can already use powered exoskeletons, for example, to make them much stronger to carry stuff around. And some athletes who have actually had to have replacement limbs are being, it's controversial because actually, are they disadvantaged, or do they now have more of an advantage because of those enhancements, for example? So this is a completely new area. So on one hand, you're going to have robots as alternative beings, if you like, and you're going to have humans. But we're also going to see this kind of middle ground developing.
Well, yeah, there's the question of building androids. I mean, we notice very clearly things like artificial limbs and stuff like that. We don't, you know, we don't think so much about the artificial brains that we carry around with us all the time in the form of personal computers, and we don't think about, you know, the radio necessarily as the kind of, you know, a human enhancement that allows us to speak to all these people who are far, far away from us. There's a question that, are we enhancing ourselves to become more like robots? Are we enhancing kind of computational stuff to become more human? Does that make it easier for us to deal with it in some way? That strange desire we have to make everything slightly humanoid.
True. I mean, what's been very interesting about why not we've gone there, I mean, the development of artificial intelligence is that school that actually sees it in terms of bottom-up planning. So, in other words, intelligence comes from movement. You know, that is the beginning of intelligence, how you actually sort of probe and traverse a space. I mean, I think about, you know, Deep Blue beating Kasparov in public over a series of games of chess, but it was incapable of moving a single piece on the board. It couldn't even get to the hall under its own power. So it's, you know, I'm far more interested now in how we're getting these kind of accumulative notions of intelligence. And how these are going to slowly build up. You were talking about people becoming computers online, you know, beginning to sort of like turn themselves almost into applications, services, which can be used. And I'm beginning to think that perhaps this is, it's never going to be a question of machines replacing humans, but somehow it's this strange kind of symbiotic evolutionary pattern developing.
I mean, we are going to have to learn to get on with them, Ken. Mm. I mean, really are, because I mean, Azumo in Japan now has come on leaps and bounds. It's a sort of 3/4 size humanoid robot that can run, it can walk, it can climb stairs, it can deliver cups of tea. I mean, and can you imagine what it's going to be able to do in 10 years' time? It's going to be your companion if you want it to be. And the kind of the idea that they'll take over is also a bit scary. But then, you know, what happens when this is over to you, Ken? But what happens when they start wanting to demand rights? You know, robot rights.
Well, I think we have to talk to them. And I've said time and time and time again that sooner or later, the most important thing that we can all do is to keep people, you know, the work they're doing, the writing they're doing, the opinions they're expressing. They should do it with the point of view that at some point in the future, machines will be reading that and judging it.
Hmm.
And I, for one, welcome our machine overlords of the future.
I'm fascinated by the very human trait that we have to kind of give emotion and emotional life to things as well. You know, we talk about Aibo, and Aibo's the dog, isn't it? And Azumo is the humanoid one.
Yeah.
But like, you know, the Roombas, the little vacuum robots.
Yeah.
People become astonishingly attached to those things. iRobot, the company that make them, have this real problem, which is that when they break, it's frequently easier to send the customer a new one, and then fix the other one at a late date. People get really upset about this. They absolutely insist on having the same Roomba back because they've got this kind of incredible, even though this thing is just like sort of this big hockey puck that just bumbles around your apartment. But it does just enough of the things that make it seem intelligent and kind of livable to make us incredibly attached to it.
I can't help but think that one of the things that's fascinating about the robot, the notion of it, you know, the final artificial, the mechanical human, is that it had its best expression in literary terms, you know, with Capek's Rustum's Universal Robots play, you know, where the term is first coined. I think it must be one of the few occasions where a sort of literary creation has actually started to sort of like morph and evolve and sort of split off and have its own existence. But I have to say, you know, I mean, as a written statement that's taken shape, it's quite unusual.
The great thing about Capek's definition of the robot is it is kind of infinitely malleable. He didn't set down exactly what the robot is. In fact, his robots were really kind of flesh and bone creatures that had been kind of assembled and programmed. But there's also the fact that you know, it comes out of an older tradition of that literature as well. You know, he basically rewrote the golem myth. You know, this kind of creature that man creates to do his bidding. But the golem myth itself kind of separates off into all these different versions. There's versions where it protects the Jews of Prague from pogroms, but there's other versions where it kind of turns on its makers and attacks them as well. And right from the start of the literary myth, you have this unknowingness of control. I mean, Capek's play as well goes into this, that eventually the robots turn on the humans and you know, destroy them. Like, we don't seem to have been able to even start to think about machines and their effect on us without seeing them as a threat that will eventually overcome us.
The curious thing about the play is that the human memories keep failing in it. They fail to remember conversation. You know, something that's said in Act One suddenly gets completely transformed into another statement in Act Two. And I think the stenographer machine at the beginning is actually able to reproduce conversations in absolutely precise detail, like a phonograph, actually fails to do it. and I'm never quite sure whether that was deliberate on Capek's part, or whether he'd, you know, he just actually not bothered to sort of check his earlier drafts. But you were saying about the kind of emotional dimension to machines. A few years back, I was doing a piece of Radio 4 on Philip K. Dick and his religious experience, this big spirit, you know, this divine invasion that took place. And for the program, we got in touch with the people who'd created the Philip K. Dick android and did an interview with them. The android was life-size replica of Philip K. Dick, sat in a full-size replica of his Orange County living room with his stereo. And he had like flubber flesh and artificial hair, but the back of the head was missing, so you could see all the wires hanging out of it. And he would sit on the couch, and you could sit with him, and you could have a conversation with him. And people, as you were saying in their relationship with the Roomba, people would get really attached to Philip K. Dick, and who was basically just producing answers that were based on a memory bank of all his previous written statements, interviews, short stories, novels, etc. But people got really involved in him. They'd hold his hand, you know, and would want to be alone with him. And we did an interview with him, and it was a really interesting one because he'd just go off on a kind of tangent, a bit like the show actually. But when we actually edited it for radio, we were really dismayed because we didn't have any of the visual cues that would tell us whether he was sort of, you know, how he was emotionally responding. And we actually spent hours having to sort of like alter the pacing of his voice, dropping syllables here and there just to get some kind of emotional warmth into it. I actually felt quite protective towards this android. And so I personally took it as a betrayal when the Philip K. Dick android went missing about 2 weeks after we broadcast the program. And he's never been found. He's never been found. Philip
he's
K. Dick's android, he is out there. You know, send the Blade Runners after him, because he's out there and he's still out there. Philip, if you're listening, please give us a call. Phone home. Let us know you're safe. That's all we need to know. This is Ken Hollings. This has been Hollingsville. Machines, History and Hardware featured contributions from guest speakers Bruce Woolley and James Bridle. Musical interludes were by Radiophonic with Steve Dubb at the controls. Background tones were by the Hollingsville composer in residence, Graham Massey. Special thanks go to Indigo Octagon for creating the show's splendid opening and closing themes. The entire broadcast has been overseen in the studio by Mark Robbins. Tune in next week for Episode 4, Networks. Welcome to the Labyrinth, when my guest speakers will be Becky Hogg and Alfie Denon. This is Ken Hollings, and this has been a Project Thrust production. Project Thrust, the name you can trust.